From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts, literally, to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions' quarantined world headquarters overlooking the evacuated San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. Shall we consider the monster for a moment? We've given a lot of well-deserved attention to the creators of the creatures, the monster makers that haunt our cinematic nightmares. They are the rock stars of horror. Rick Baker, Greg Nicotero, and Howard Berger from KNB, the Kyoto Brothers, Tom Savini, Billy Corso, so many other brilliant and talented artists who've taken the art of monster maker far beyond anything realized by their forebears, Lon Chaney, Jack Pierce, and Dick Smith blazed trails in creature creation that leave an indelible mark to this day. They make the monsters, but what of the actors who portray them? Lon Chaney was known as the Man of a Thousand Faces, and not only played the Hunchback of Notre Dame and the Phantom of the Opera, but designed and applied his own extensive makeups. His son, Lon Chaney Jr., was the Wolfman and the Mummy, even Frankenstein's monster, who was first and inimitably portrayed by the great Boris Karloff. Christopher Lee brought new life to both Dracula and Frankenstein in the Hammer films in the UK. Robert Englund's Freddy Krueger is the only true Freddy Krueger, despite attempts to modernize him. The men and their makeups made for unforgettable moments. But as a good horror movie must first be a good drama, a good monster is a complex combination of brilliant makeup and a fine actor. The monsters that last came to life because Karloff and the Chaneys, Lee, Englund, and all of the best of the bunch were terrific performers, really talented, deep actors who took their roles seriously and played them like Shakespeare. We still have our performers who specialize in monster performances, Kane Hodder, Derek Mears, and a handful of other talented actors who bring our fears to life. But none more than our guest, who has played everything from aliens to moonheads to fishmen and creatures of all stripes, a man who is equally galvanizing under the makeup as well. We will get to meet the modern Man of a Thousand Faces, Doug Jones, after this. Fright Rags has been giving you the best in horror apparel and accessories since 2003, offering hundreds of products for fan-favorite films. This week, Joe Bob Briggs is back with a new season of The Last Drive-In, and Fright Rags is celebrating with a new t-shirt, classic reprints, two new hats, as well as their very first action figure. That's right, now you can get Joe Bob Briggs as a collectible 3.75-inch figure with 4 points of articulation foo, one set of drive-in speakers, one beer bottle, and beer foo grip. Who wouldn't want that? They are $20 each and limited to 1,000, available exclusively at fright-rags.com. Postmortem listeners get 10% off when they use the code POSTMORTEM10. Joe Bob Briggs on your shelf. Fangoria is offering a free 2-month digital membership to everyone. Go to Fangoria.com for more information and to make an account. Then pore over all the exclusive articles, interviews, and reviews on the site, as well as original video content and podcasts like Postmortem. You'll even have access to high-resolution scans of the original run of Fangoria magazine. Go to Fangoria.com now to start your free digital membership. And if you're looking to add to your social distancing watch list, Fangoria's latest movie, VFW, is now available to stream on demand, and Satanic Panic and Puppet Master The Littlest Reich are streaming on Shudder now. And by the way, so is Nightmare Cinema. Celebrate the master of horror and the mistress of the dark this month with brand new apparel from your friends at Cavity Colors. Officially licensed, Elvira sweatpants are perfect for in-home quarantine lounging, and horrifying new shirts honoring 40 years of John Carpenter's The Fog. The first movie I ever worked on, by the way. Cavity Colors is jam-packed full of officially licensed products for some of your favorite horror movies, including George A. Romero's Day of the Dead, Poltergeist, Killer Clowns from Outer Space, Chopping Mall, as well as more recent favorites like Haunt and The Cabin in the Woods. Use the promo code MORTEM for 15% off your order at cavitycolors.com, and you'll stay spooky forever. I'm so glad to finally get this off the ground. We've been trying to make it happen for a while. You are one of my favorite performers, and the fact that we both had beginning points in our careers centered around one particular movie that seems to have lasted along with us is a great treat to finally make it happen.
Oh, well, the treat is, and the honor is all mine. And thank you for that introduction, which I cannot live up to. But
you already have, my friend.
Very kind of you.
So how does a kid from Indiana find his way into the hearts of horror fans everywhere to become the premier creature performer in the business these days?
Oh, well, very kind of you to call me that, but as far as the kid from Indiana and his dreams, monsters wasn't a part of it. Honestly, back in the day, I grew up on funny things, sitcoms and musicals and feel goods. So when I came out to Hollywoodland in 1985, I was pursuing that goofy sidekick on a sitcom kind of a role, tall, skinny, goofy guy. You know, I thought if I could come in, do armpit farts and ask for a cup of sugar from my neighbor, that would be my career. Right.
So the comedy was the first thing. I mean, Night Angel is one of the first things you did. And it is that comedic. You dance up a storm in that one, too.
Oh, God bless you for even knowing about Night Angel. Heavens.
Who are we? Right.
Yeah. Right. Well, and in that movie, right, I was indeed the tall, skinny, goofy sidekick to the handsome guy and got to, you know, curly hair, baseball cap, the whole nine yards for the 80s. But I did not know that what I walked into Hollywood with was going to be so lusted after by the creature effects makeup artists and the horror makers. I'm 6'3 and a half, weigh 140 pounds, have since high school, and with a mime background that I got from Ball State University. I was in a mime troupe there called Mime Over Matter. Get it?
Oh, there you go. Very clever.
Yeah,
very
clever. A little play on words there, Mick. with that kind of a background, and then I also was the mascot at my university at Ball State. I was Charlie Cardinal for a couple of years.
So you were in a bird suit?
Big bird suit, right. So I had no idea that I had been training for the career that I ended up having. Because I didn't know that was a career option, honestly. I had seen... the classic horror films, you know, the black and white Universal monsters back in the day on reruns on TV. The Creature from the Black Lagoon was one of my first. My first was actually The Mummy with Boris Karloff. Ah. And those left, you know, such deep feelings and such deep memories for me. But I never thought, there's an actor that would have done that. You know, to me, they were monsters and I was afraid of them and rightfully so.
Right.
So it was honestly, because I had mime, contortionist, and those college mascot things on my resume in my special skills section, my first commercial agent sent me out on everything that was for physical tomfoolery, pratfalls, if it required clowning or miming in any way. And often those roles would come with some kind of a makeup or costume that would be other than human or
before we get too deep into that, how you were a contortionist, where do you utilize those skills?
I know I did not travel with the circus. I was actually, my contorting is basically I'm a forward roller with my being able to put my legs behind my head. And so but that's my one party trick. So that's where I did it. I did it in front of groups of friends, like, oh, guess what I can do? Fit it! Yeah.
So I fit in a box really well.
And I fit in a box really well. Yeah. I did a commercial for Lee Jeans way back in the day where I put it, they fit me into a really tiny plexiglass box while wearing this comfortable stretchy jean that they had just come out with. So I guess that's where you utilize it. I don't know, but because that contortionist was on my resume, it came into play so much. I mean, TV commercials, especially being able to do a sight gag where you can do something that's that physically extreme. It's like, but it also brings a laugh. And so it would often be a punchline in a commercial or I would do cameos on sitcoms, little things like that all the time. So my early days, thank goodness the contortionist thing was there.
Well, it also shows that you can't be claustrophobic, which has served you well because of all these makeups. I know that when I did Michael Jackson's Thriller, when I was one of the zombies going through the face casting process and the 3 hours of makeup, I am claustrophobic and it was torture for me. You have to be the mellowest guy in the world to do all of these things. Done.
Right. Well, you know, you can't turn claustrophobia on or off. I don't think it's either there. Or it isn't.
It's there. Or it's not.
Yeah.
And Valium or otherwise.
Yeah. You're right. Right. So, thankfully that's just never been a problem for me. One time I was getting a life cast done. I was getting under the alginate and the plaster, head and shoulders for my role as the lead spy Morlock in the remake of The Time Machine, right, with Guy Pearce. Oh, yeah. And for one split second, I had a freak out moment, but it always helps to have somebody there to just grab my hand. We'll be fine. That's in my 34 year. Yeah.
Also good psychotherapists as well. Yes.
No, creature effects makeup people have to have a great bedside manner because they have to be a nursing home assistant as well as a makeup artist.
Well, one of your first national works that brought attention to you was indeed Under a Mask. You were Mac Tonight. You were the moon head in the McDonald's commercials, right?
Right. There's a throwback. Yes, indeed. That was the late 80s. I think 1987 is when they went. Was when the commercials went national, and lasted for about three. I did my last commercial for them in 1990. We did a 3 year run of 27 commercials. Bought my first house with that. Thank heaven. Thanks for McDonald's.
Yes. That's one of the few reasons to say thanks to McDonald's.
Yeah. Yeah. Other than that, my cholesterol doesn't thank them, but.
Well, there was Night Angel. There were a lot of little independent movies and things, but kind of your first studio feature was, it happened later. I wrote it eight years before it was produced, but in Hocus Pocus, you made quite a splash as Bad Billy Butcherson.
Yes. Now, the one studio film I was involved with just before that was Batman Returns, but in a very small role. I was in about six scenes of that. And it was because Batman Returns was on my resume that it helped me get the audition for Hocus Pocus. So I do clump those together. I got a casting director, Greg Smith. He was often a dance casting director. My audition came through his end to Kenny Ortega, director. And we did my audition for Billy Butcherson, the goofy zombie, in a dance studio in Burbank. And I'll never forget that day because I was just the usual nerves. And And Kenny Ortega, being a choreographer and a movement person and so artistically expressive physically, you know, he was my director. I'm just like instant kismet, where we loved each other immediately. And he had a boombox in the room, and he turned on some music and told me to get from point A to point B. You're a dead guy waking up, and you're going to see this this witch who you know put you there in the grave. So enjoy. I just kind of improv this scene, and I knew I had him when the entire room at the other end of the dance studio was laughing hysterically before I even stood up all the way. So I figured, okay, I think I got this one.
Yeah, that was such a great performance. And tell me about the first time you saw the makeup, when the makeup was on and you became Billy Butcherson. Tell me how that felt and how it affected your performance.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah. And the look of a character like that will often affect my performance. Everything weighs in. Your beautiful script absolutely weighs in. It informs me where I fit into the story and how I relate to the other characters. A meeting with the director with his notes on what I should be. But that makeup, when that makeup goes on, that is the final button on the sweater that makes me my character. Right. So Tony Gardner, bless Tony Gardner's heart at Alterian Studios, he had one of his sculptors, Chet Czar, sculpt this bust of Billy Butcherson. And when it was applied onto me for the first time, it changed my bone structure ever so slightly, but it was a dead version of me, but they made me but they made me much more handsome than I am in real life. It was like,
that's not true, Doug.
No. Well, I looked at myself and I said, that is a hot zombie. Okay.
And it's really so much fun. Tony Gardner had done Psycho 4 for me and Sleepwalkers right before that.
Oh, and you two were also in that Michael Jackson Thriller video together, if I remember right.
That's right. All of the makeup guys were made each other up for themselves. And so most of the zombies, the close-up zombies you see in Thriller are makeup effects guy. My wife Cynthia and I are both zombies in it, and Rick and Tony and all of them. Yeah. Greg Canham, really amazing. It was like a Masters of Horror, but all makeup effects masters.
totally, yeah.
So that kind of changed the course of your career, did it not? Did you not start getting offered mostly that kind of under makeup jobs?
Yes. Not only the notoriety of the film, and the notoriety of the film has grown exponentially over the years, as you know, right? You know, yeah. We went from a dismal box office in 1993 to doing a 25-year anniversary celebration on the Freeform channel with millions of viewers around the world going, yes!
Okay. So much fun. It was great. That's the last time I think I saw you was at that.
Oh, so fun. What was your question? I'm sorry.
Well, just that it led to more creature jobs.
Yes. And that's when I realized the importance of relationships within Hollywood. Tony Gardner, who we've been talking about, was the first creature effects person that really started the referral process on me. He would remember me and call me back in. I did over 10 jobs with him, characters for him in different things, from everything from a FedEx commercial to more movies, and even like a cameo in Adaptation where he put a beard and a wig on me. Just everything. And we Warriors of Virtue, the kangaroo movie for 8-year-old boys that I played one of the kangaroos in.
Best damn kangaroo movie, battle movie that I've ever not seen.
Right. Well, yeah. So, and that was back in that. That was 1997. That came out. So it's all been a while. Tony was really a key player in the referrals of Doug Jones and getting seen by more and more creature effects makeup artists. And the creature effects makeup world in Hollywood land is very incestuous. People that work in as a mold maker or a sculptor, but they might go from one shop to the other as work dies down or mounts back up again. So I'll get a referral from a shop I'd never worked for because someone there had worked at maybe Tony's shop before. So that really started throwing the net wider and wider for me personally, as being known as the guy who tall, skinny guy who moves well and wears rubber bits.
and can act and is funny. That's something that is often not really recognized in people who do excel in playing creatures. They have to be truly fine actors because they have to act beyond the layers of latex. And it's easy to forget there are just monsters who go rawr and rip shred people and all. Right. But the humanity in the creature in Shape of Water, you know, well, in fact, let's lead up to that. Tell me how your association with Guillermo del Toro began back in Mimic, how that started.
Right. 1997. I got one of those referral phone calls from a creature shop. I think it was a Rick Lazzarini's shop was doing the bugs, the giant cockroaches that took over the New York subway system in Mimic. Yeah. I got a call that they were doing pickup shots for like additional photography for the movie, like 3 weeks before it hit the theaters in Los Angeles. Now, they filmed principal photography in Toronto. So there was a Toronto Canadian actor who was tall, skinny, who had played these bug creatures previously in principal photography. But to get him down to Los Angeles to, you know, work permits, travel, hotel. So, hey, who do we know locally? So the tall, skinny Rolodex comes out and guess whose name is in there, right? So I got that call. And could I come down to downtown L.A. that night for a night shoot? And I'm like, you know, out of work actor. Yes, I'm free. So I ended up on the top of a 3-story brick building looking down with a rain machine hitting me in the head while I was wearing a bug mask and a very human-like trench coat-y thing that was made out of sort of bug wings. It was, you know, that human-bug hybrid sort of thing from that movie. Never met the director that night because everyone was down on the ground and I was getting yelled at through a megaphone. I did my one little leaning over the edge of the building, and that was a cut, and that was a wrap for the night for me. Next day, I got called back in to do a green screen shot on with a smaller skeleton crew on a green screen soundstage. That's when I met our director, Guillermo del Toro. At lunchtime, he sat across the table from me, put his chin in his hands and said, "So tell me everything you've been in before."
Had you seen Kronos? Did you know that film?
I did not know who this man was at the time, right? I was one of those dumb American audiences who did not. I had not seen a lot of films with subtitles, right? So Kronos was getting critical acclaim that he made in Mexico with Ron Perlman, we might add,
right?
And I did not know any of that, and so now this director is. I guess Mimic was his first American studio film.
Right.
And here he is asking me to tell him what I've been in before. So by that time, I recounted things like Warriors of Virtue and Hocus Pocus and the Mac Tonight campaign, the things we've talked about. And so he was getting more excited talking to me. And I was getting more excited talking to him because he told me that he started as a makeup artist and a creature creator for his own projects and short films and things in television in Mexico. Oh my gosh, I love this man. Who is he? He was talking like a 12-year-old fanboy, right? So I loved him.
Well, I met him around that time. Well, I met him right after he made Kronos.
Yeah.
He screened it for me because he wanted me to consider using Guillermo Navarro as my DP on The Stand when we were about to make that. Now, there was no way I could make that happen because Guillermo had never done an American television shoot or anything like that. But I had seen Kronos, and of course, he'd seen Ron Perlman in Sleepwalkers, and then... You know, later on, we worked with Ron again a couple of times. But so this world becomes quite small, as you were saying, with the creature creators. Yeah. It's incestuous, but people who make movies, particularly in the genre, their paths cross often. And so that's where I first met Guillermo. Then later on, of course, he named the Masters of Horror when we had those dinners. But anyway, so you were meeting with Guillermo at that time and hitting it off like crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And so he took a card from me after that day on the set. And then 5 years later, in 2002, I got another random phone call from Steve Wang, who I had worked with on a movie in Australia. It was called Tooth Fairy originally, renamed Darkness Falls.
Darkness Falls, I believe.
Is that it? Darkness Falls?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. It was a Tooth Fairy themed movie. And right. Steve Wang's creature that he made for me, I was the Tooth Fairy in the original version of the film, but had been replaced with another character after a screening. Who knows what? But it's a shame that Steve Wang's very haunting Tooth Fairy character was never seen on film. But Steve and I had that history, and he called to say, "Hey, I'm over at a new studio called Spectral Motion, headed up by Mike Elizalde. We're having dinner right now with a director who says he knows you." So that was Guillermo del Toro.
Right.
And what had happened earlier that day, they had shown him and unveiled for him the sculpture that Jose Fernandez had done of the maquette of Abe Sapien for the first Hellboy movie.
Ah.
So my name came up in a room full of friendly people that have worked with me before. And they all said, "Hey, you know who should play this? Is Doug Jones." Guillermo said, "Doug Jones, wait, I know Doug Jones." And he pulled my card out of his wallet that I gave him 5 years earlier.
Number hadn't changed.
The number hadn't changed. They called me, right? It was like, that was a glorious moment. And so they called me in the next day. I went and met with him the next day. And I showed him my demo reel of what things I'd done since we'd seen each other last. And he's like, "Oh," by then I'd done Buffy the Vampire Slayer as the gentleman of the Hush episode.
Right.
And as that character moved and gestured very, very gently and very fluidly, Guillermo said, "Oh, I love those hands. Oh, that's what, exactly perfect for this role." So
you do a very good Guillermo.
Oh, thank you, my friend. So, it was just fabulous. We picked up right where we left off after 5 years, and that Hellboy was the movie that really cemented our relationship, where we got to know each other as actor, director, and that shorthand that is so rare in our business, where you know, you really just click with someone, so that I understand him, he understands me, he knows my weaknesses and my strengths better than I do. He's really the most brilliant director I think I've ever worked with in my entire life. And sure. And every other director knows that, and they're fine with that.
Well, Hellboy was a big studio franchise type film. It was based on a popular comic book, and that has, for years, that has been the best way to have a hit movie, has come from a popular comic book. But your next work together was on Pan's Labyrinth, which is kind of the opposite. Very artful, very dark, very haunting, and very independent. So tell me about how the experiences might have been different from all of the trailers and everything on one to something that had to have been much more intimate.
Right. Money. That was the difference.
You never know it by looking at it.
And you wouldn't know it by looking. And I knew that going in. By that time, Guillermo del Toro sent me an email saying that he was in Spain. He was prepping this a movie he was going to do in the Spanish language called Pan's Labyrinth, and he said that there's a character, the title character Pan the Fawn, can only be played by you, he said. And while you're looking at the script, I also want you to look at a little scene where there's a pale man, just something. And he kind of fluffed that one off, like, "Yeah, I want you to look at that too. So can you read the script and get back to me by 11 o'clock tonight, your time?" So I knew what my day was going to be. So I read the script, and by this time, this was 2005 that this email transaction was happening. By this time, I was known just enough that I was getting offers for a lot of horror films that were blood splatter on the wall kind of horror films, where, you
not
know,
your cup of tea, right?
Not my cup of tea, right? Naked teenagers running around the woods. Oh no, here comes Doug Jones to kill all of us one at a time. Not my favorite thing. Yes. So I had been offered two of those earlier that same week and had said and had declined both of them because they just didn't artistically sing to me. So now I'm reading the script for Pan's Labyrinth. Oh, Mick, you're a writer. You understand. Oh, when you read something that gorgeous, that delicious, that you just want to chew on it and savor it and take it to bed.
You can tell his heart and soul is completely immersed in that yes. script, in that film.
Yes, yes, yes. And knowing that he was going to be the one directing what I just read, it was like, well, this is an absolute no-brainer. So the email I sent back to him in Spain was all, in all caps with lots of exclamation points. Of course, yes, yes, of course, I want to do it. Ah! Right. So that was just a glorious, and the fact that he trusted me so much with that personal piece for him.
Yeah, and playing two parts in it as well was two parts,
and the Fawn, of course, in the Spanish language, which I didn't speak. So I tried to convince him he had the wrong guy at one point when I realized, oh no, I don't know Spanish. I'm going to ruin your movie.
But it's also not contemporary Spanish. You had to learn a fairly archaic form of Spanish, right? A dialect,
right? And because of my insecurities, he told me at the time, he said, "Oh, don't worry about that. You can count to 10 for all I care and I'll dub over it later, but you are the one to play Pan." So that kind of gave me a little bit of a reprieve, like, well, okay, I guess my language doesn't have to be perfect because he can voice over this. And I don't love being dubbed over, mind you, but in a language you don't speak, it called for it. But I thought, you know what? I cannot count to 10 on film. I can't do that to my co-star, Ivana Baquero. She was an 11-year-old girl at the time. You can't count to 10 with emotion and expect another actor to live in the moment with you.
Yeah, it's a two-way street. Yeah,
absolutely. So my lip movement would have made lip sync impossible. So it would have looked like a dub job. So I did buckle down and I learned the Spanish language of that film. I had an English script and a Spanish script side by side, so I could break down the sentence structure and realize what I was saying and where to put my inflections and all the whole nine yards. And then I was dubbed over in post-production by a Spanish actor who could hear the nuances of the language and that I couldn't.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, that continued with The Strain and obviously Shape of Water, which is, again, even though it was a studio movie of sorts, it was so independent and so from the heart and so Guillermo. Nobody could have made that movie except Guillermo.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. And it was 2014, February. I was sitting in Guillermo del Toro's office while we were filming Crimson Peak. I was two of his ghost ladies in that.
Right, of course.
And on one of my days off, he met me at lunchtime in his office to close the door and have a private little talk about this other movie he was thinking of after this was done. And that was The Shape of Water. So he didn't have a script yet. He had it all the storyline in his head. And he said, I had a little fireside chat with Guillermo where he had story time. I said, well, what's it about? Well, and he explained the whole storyline of The Shape of Water. And I was just like, this is gorgeous. And I knew sitting in his office that day, I said, this is going to be his next trip back to the Oscars again after Pan's Labyrinth. And did I call it, Mick? 13 nominations, 4 wins. Yeah.
Tell me about that experience, about Oscar.
Gosh. Well, you know, Pan's Labyrinth was my first trip to the Oscars. I was invited to go to represent the film on the red carpet and all that as well. So I've been to the Oscars twice, only twice, and both times were with a Guillermo del Toro film. So that was a big honor for me. It's the Super Bowl for the entertainment industry. It's our prom, you know. And so when you're with that much Hollywood royalty all around you, it's just a press line that goes on for an hour and a half. If you stop at every outlet along the way, it takes you an hour and a half to get in the building. That alone, but then knowing that so much was riding on this for Guillermo. Now, we'd been through the Golden Globes already, where he won Best Director, and it had how many nominations at the Golden Globes, maybe 7-ish. Yeah. So it was so much. So it was a nervous night indeed. But when the two moments that meant the most to me was Guillermo getting his Best Director statuette to win that award and to stand there and hold that and caress it while he gave his acceptance speech was just, after 20 years of working with that man, I had been longing for this moment. then at the end of the night, when they announced Best Picture, and we all got to run up on stage, and I'll never forget the snapshot moment standing behind him, seeing the back of his head as he addressed the entire Dolby Theater, holding another gold statuette for Best Picture. It was just a snapshot that I will savor forever. I was so proud to be a part of that.
What glorious validation, not only for that film and all of the people who made it, but for the genre too, that is normally treated with complete disrespect.
Well, right. If it has a creature in it, then it must be in this other category, right?
When you're on the red carpet, the mainstream press is obviously very superficial in so many ways. Did they have any idea who you were? Fishman.
Yes. Thankfully, I had a Fox Searchlight publicist with me. So that helped a lot. And by that time, though, I had been doing press for the movie for months before this.
Right.
So much Doug Jones press had been happening more than ever in my life before because of two things, actually. Star Trek Discovery Season 1 had already aired.
Right.
And now Shape of Water was, you know, getting all of its awards and attention. And then who's the fish guy was a question everybody wanted to know. So a lot of pieces had been done on me in the mainstream, but both print and TV and radio. I did a lot of NPR interviews and that kind of thing. So
I remember them very, very well. We paid attention.
Oh, bless you. Thank you. So that helped the red carpet go a bit more smoothly with the who the heck are you thing.
Well, let's go back to your childhood for a moment. You're the youngest of four kids. Your father was a teacher and an entrepreneur, but also a politician in Indiana politics. So tell me what life was like for a young Doug Jones that made you want to seek out the performing side. What did you watch? What did you love? What inspired you?
Right. being the youngest of four boys that were all my three older brothers, very, very handsome, very athletic. And here I was, this gangly kid who couldn't catch or toss a ball. So my dad was a very self-starter. He rose in local politics in Indiana, where we lived, and he even started a church in our house because he wanted to. He just like anything he wanted, he just went out and did.
My brother did that. He for years was the pastor of his own church, mm-hmm. first in his home and then at a church that existed, and they would come in and do theirs.
He was successful at anything he touched. And he had a consulting business anything he did. So living in that shadow was kind of like, what am I ever going to amount to? And all my brothers, all three of my brothers went to college on full ride athletic scholarships. And I was the one who had to pay for it for college. So I think it was the gangly kids are cruel to each other. If you don't fit it, especially in the Midwest, I guess, there was a very specific a thin slice of normal. And if you were outside of that thin slice of normal, you were made fun of. It was just part of the deal.
It was here too. I'm here to attest to you. It was in California.
Okay. Okay, good. Yeah. So kids are cruel. I think we can all agree on that. But so to combat that, I developed a sense of humor, and I thought, if people are going to be laughing at me because I have a long, skinny neck and they're going to call me ostrich when I'm not looking or to my face, how about if I do something funny before they get to that so that I know why they're laughing now? I can control why they're laughing. So that's where a goofy sense of humor came from. And that was inspired by, you asked what I was watching, Jerry Lewis movies, Dick Van Dyke, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Gilligan's Island, Gomer Pyle, Barney Fife on the Mayberry RFD show. Please, that was Don Knotts was my hero. So if I and they inspired me. If those goofy guys can have be successful and have a reason to live, then so can I. And so I think that's why, and they were on my TV screen. So I thought, maybe I need to be on that same TV screen one day. Maybe that's where I belong. That's where it all started.
And were your parents supportive of your endeavors in the show business field?
Well, as any good Midwestern parent should do, they tried to dissuade me. because it's like in Indiana, it's like there aren't a whole lot of, none of your neighbors are making a full-time living from the show biz. So that didn't make sense. But express yourself artistically. Sure, we'll support. We'll show up to your high school plays when you're in them. Yes, if you want to dance in a musical, we'll come cheer you on. But you're going to go to college and you're going to major in something that you can get a job in. How about that? So they're supportive as much as they could be. Yeah.
What was that major?
I majored in, I wanted to stay in some kind of a media driven major. So I majored in radio and TV broadcasting.
I did that too.
Did you? And I had a minor in theater just to keep my toe dabbled in there.
Good. So what was the first opportunity that allowed you to leave Indiana and get work in film or television?
Stage? Right. The job opportunity that helped, I was married by now. I married my college sweetheart, Lori. And so Lori and I had been married for 11 months when I interviewed for and got a job in California as a bank management trainee for Security Pacific Bank, which is long gone now. But that was our moving job. That was the job we could move to California for. But I wanted to get that bank job in Los Angeles, California, because I knew this is where the showbiz lived. And I thought if I can just get us out there, relocate us out there and have a job to get to, that's the safer way to move for me. And then that job lasted. Oh, Mick. Banker? No.
I don't get it. I don't see you doing it.
Yeah, square peg, round hole. I wearing a tie every day and carrying a briefcase and trying to learn how to supervise that line of tellers and be responsible for all the cash in the vault. Really bad fit. So they fired me. I lasted 8 months and when they fired me, I cried for an hour. And then after that, I was like, hallelujah, I'm free. So
the chains have been released.
Right. So I went on unemployment and took my first TV commercial acting class. And it was from that class. That class was taught by a commercial agent that was at the Wilhelmina agency.
Which originally was a modeling agency.
Modeling agency in New York with a big name one. And yeah, their West Coast office had a huge TV commercial department in the top 10 in the city. So here I fell into the hands of this man because of his acting class. And after my second class, he said, here's my card. Call me at the office. And I owe Philip Carr a lot for that little gesture, because they did take me on and I did start auditioning for commercials. And after 6 months of auditioning, I landed my first spot in June of 1986.
Wow. And
that was a Southwest Airlines commercial where I played a dancing mummy. I could draw back to my first horror film I ever saw of Boris Karloff as the mummy for my inspiration.
Nice circle of life here. Yeah,
exactly.
So you did a lot of commercials. You did music videos as well. Tell me about that experience. Were you a dancer by training, or was it something you just felt good at and beautifully done in Night Angel? I want to repeat. Was that something you had studied? And is that why you did so many commercials and music videos and things?
No, I'm not a trained dancer. I am a freestyle Dougie Goes Crazy dancer. That's what I am. I'm bandy legged the only organized dancing I ever did was in a folk dance troupe in college called the Bonnevokes. And we did folk dances from around the world. And so I learned, that's the only time I really was really ever choreographed and rehearsed on stage. Otherwise, it's freestyle Dougie.
Yeah, that's what we want to see. Yeah. Freestyle. Well, tell me about the music video experience.
Yeah. Well, I did a few, and I love those shoots so much because they're, you know, the storyline was visual. Well, there's a song playing, of course, so I didn't have to memorize any dialogue, which was great. But I did a couple of high profile ones. Probably the biggest high profile one was for the Red Hot Chili Peppers. The song was Soul to Squeeze, and right. I was a contortionist in that. The whole setting of this was a black and white video that was it was following a traveling circus gang around back in the Dust Bowl sort of 1930s. And our ringmaster on the road with us, as you saw, setting up tents and getting into trailers and going on the road in this storyline, was Chris Farley. He was the one who passed away, right? Yes. So it was Chris Farley. Yeah. So getting to meet him and you know the Red Hot Chili Peppers. All Anthony Kiedis was such a sweetheart. Flea was such a sweetheart. So they were just great guys. And I worked on that for 3 days and had a great time with that. I did. I was in a Marilyn Manson video. Now get this.
Yes, I was going to mention this one.
Yes, my agent called to say, "Hey, you've just have a straight up offer to be in a Marilyn Manson video," and I had not heard of Marilyn Manson. So I said, "Oh, she sounds like a lovely lady. Of course, I'll do it." Not realizing that Marilyn Manson was a fella and an eccentric one at that. So I was, I believe the song was, I Don't Like the Drugs, But the Drugs Like Me. Was that the title?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And, the theme of this video was, the TV culture and how it was kind of set in the future where all of us consumers watching too much TV, our eyes have morphed and evolved into these huge eyes. That's because that's all we use. And so we sit still and we watch TV. So I wore a prosthetic makeup that Barry Koper applied to me.
Of course you did.
Yes, of course I did. With huge eyes. So it was the upper half of the face with a big forehead and a wig in that, just to do a few vignettes and things. And I also did a Madonna video. This was hilarious. I was supposed to be part of a tall, thin couple. So they had a very tall supermodel, thin a young lady that was sitting next to me on a bench with our feet in a pond that koi were swimming around in. And we were both wearing matching like smoking jacket robes, like all down to the floor while we're sitting in this water. And we held our hands artistically together just so, and had to hold very still while a camera zoomed in on us. That's all we knew. I was like, oh, well, that's an interesting shot, whatever. The video comes out, our heads have been replaced with hand mirrors, and on the face of the hand mirror was Madonna, her face singing. So from the neck down, I'm in a Madonna video for one quick shot.
Yeah, my music video experience was being a zombie in Thriller, and then I directed for a couple weeks a Michael Jackson video that fell apart during the Scandal era and continued 3 years later, and I was no longer a part of it. But man, that experience was phenomenal to have gone through. Mm-hmm. Probably, other than your work with Guillermo, the Star Trek character has been the most popular, maybe what you're best known for. When you go to conventions and the like, that's probably what the fans talk to mm-hmm. to you about the most is STD. Well, maybe I shouldn't say STD. Right. Star Trek Discovery and your character there. Tell me a little bit about how that came about and what you feel you brought to it yourself. The personality of Doug Jones that infected this character.
No, thanks. Well, I Saru is a Kelpian, and the Kelpian species is brand new to the Star Trek universe. Has never been seen or heard of in any of the other franchise TV shows or movies. So to help develop and build a species from the ground up was quite an honor for me, has been and continues to be. So the Kelpians are these tall, skinny, very, very elegant creatures that would remind you of a gazelle in the wild. And I was first approached by, again, this was a referral from my creature effects makeup people that I love and adore, Glenn Hetrick, who did supervise my makeup for Legion as the ice cream man. And Neville Page, who we all sat together and when I was a guest judge on Face Off, the makeup competition show. Well, the two of them had formed a company called Alchemy Labs, and they were the ones commissioned to create the creatures for Star Trek Discovery. I got a call, and here's this lead role, and I then met with the our then showrunner Brian Fuller and Aaron and Gretchen.
The brilliant Brian Fuller, who has been on the show,
brilliant.
Is phenomenal, and he really brought so much of his personality into the Star Trek universe.
Absolutely, right. And so the first thing they told me about Saru is that he was going to be sort of, even though he's not Vulcan, Kelpian is very different, but he's going to be sort of the Spock of this series. Mm-hmm. And so with that, I'm like, oh, because being born in 1960, having seen the original series in 1966 and beyond on network television with my family in my living room, Spock was the character I related to because he was the oddball. He was the one who looked a little different, who was tall and thin and had his own, human versus Vulcan to overcome. I got him. And so to be a character, I'm the odd looking one on the bridge of the Starship Discovery.
Right.
Was just okay. I'm in. I love this whole idea, and so then again, like I said before, developing the character. We have the script to work with. We have now notes with our showrunners and our writers, and like, what's the Kelpian backstory? Where do I come from? I'm a prey species, so therefore there was another species on my home planet that was the predator, which we find out later as you watch the show, who they are and why they did what they did, why they suppressed us like they did. But going into it, all I knew is I'm a prey species, so I'm a subordinate to someone else, another kind of creature. So that's why the gazelle thing came into. So gazelles are prey in the wild. Watch a lioness go after one, and you got your story. So, but they're also crafty, and they know how to outfox, distract and get away from. They know how to protect themselves as well. So, and if you get behind one, they have a good kick. So there were a lot of things that I got from nature to help develop Saru and Kelpians. The next thing, but I'll tell you, getting the makeup on again was the final button on that sweater. And the look of Saru, the makeup went through two stages. Originally, I had two winged crests that came up off my head, and I had 10 eyeballs in my face. It was a very extreme design. We did one makeup test, and it was very heavy on my head, and I had to look, and I was looking through pinholes because these eyes were placed not where my eyes are. Mm-hmm. And that post-production CG, a lot of work, a lot of money. So I think Neville called me after that makeup test. Neville Page, bless his heart, I'm so glad he did this, to say, what were your true feelings about this? Because we had network people there, and I was in a good mood and, tried to keep this moving along. But when he called me afterwards and said, okay, privately, quiet, you and me, tell me how you felt about that. I said, Neville, if I'm on this show for years upon years, this is going to get cumbersome. And I said, and I also, if I have emotion to play with other characters one-on-one, 10 eyeballs are not as easy to connect with, just emotionally. And Neville said, I completely and totally agree. I want more of you. The Doug Jones that I know and love, he said, I want more of that in this character. So let me come up. So he showed me the new design days later of the Saru that you see and know now. And I said, oh my gosh, that's him. That's it. I love him. Thank you so much. So the network was happy with it too. So that's why where the look came.
That's one of the great things. It's a makeup job, but it's still Doug Jones shining through. You're not completely hidden by that. And that's an important thing for makeup effects people, as well as actors and directors, to keep in mind is, if you want humanity in your character, you've got to let the actor shine through the latex. And that can be very demanding and difficult, especially if it's an immobile kind of makeup. It can hide all subtleties of an eyebrow or a forehead or a mouth or whatever. Those expressions are important.
Right. Depending on the character. And I've had over my career of 34 years, I've had characters that have had that where none of my expression can make it through, or a lot of it can, and everything, all the gray area in between. So, you know, when your facial expressions don't read outside, you do have to use the rest of yourself to compensate. That's where the hand gestures come in. That's where a tilt of the head comes in. That's where a shrug of the shoulders can come in. And all of that can then imply what the face is doing. So you just have to learn the balance of it. So Saru, thank heaven, is more expressive than I imagined he could be. And I just love that. Also, the hoof boots, my footwear. I have hoof boots, which again helps sell the gazelle element of this character.
If not, your spine a lot of good.
Right. So I was terrified putting them on the first time because it's a high heel sort of shoe without a heel behind you. So you're balancing on the ball of your foot. Well, when I put those on for the first time, I had to sort of alter my posture to balance, right? Pushing my hips a little bit forward, making my hands drape a little bit behind me instead of side by side. So I started walking around the costume fitting area, and my hands naturally started swaying behind me. And that's where Saru's walk came from within minutes of putting my boots on the first time. People ask me all the time about that Saru's walk and how did you develop that? And it was thank heaven for the boots. Because, you know, every new character that I am assigned, I want him to have his own life and his own look and his own ecosystem that I haven't played before. And now after 34 years, that's hard to do because I'm just one guy, right? So those boots really did help me find a new unique thing for Saru that I've never played before.
Well, versatility is a real hallmark of your career, this 34 years of acting. You've been able to play a lot without makeup, as well as every kind of makeup you can imagine. Tell me about the Doug Jones performances where you're not obscured by makeup that have felt the most rooted in your personality, that really feel, or whether they're well-known or not, the ones that you would like an audience to experience you.
Oh, well, thank you for this. It's very, very sweet of you. The Doug Jones with my own face characters that I love and the projects I've been in are lesser known, more indie vibe type films. I think my favorite human I've ever played is a character named Jerry from a movie called My Name is Jerry. And you can find that on the YouTube for free in its entirety. My Name is Jerry. I played the title character of Jerry, who was a middle-aged white guy going through a midlife crisis, which I am and have done. So, so it was written specifically for me at the time, and I had a great time playing him. And I got to film that back in my home state of Indiana and during the summertime, and I was in heaven doing that.
Well, we'll talk about more of them, but what was that midlife crisis that afflicted you?
Oh, yeah. I turned 40 in the year 2000. I'm a month away from turning 60, by the way, Mick. So I'm getting up there.
Welcome. We're right, eager to have you.
Yeah. No, bless you. So, but when I turned 40, you know, when you're an actor and you're in a youth driven business, turning 40 can feel like a death sentence. And I had just been, but what was happening right around that time, I had just been offered two movies at the same time. At the time, Jodie Foster was trying to ramp up. She was directing a movie called Flora Plum, directed by Jodie, starring Russell Crowe and Claire Danes. And it was a circus theme movie. And I had been, after meeting with Jodie, she wanted to cast me as the circus contortionist that befriended Russell Crowe's character, who was a trapeze artist with lots of hair on him, on his back. There was that. And it was going to be a smaller, but it was going to be more like a Del Toro, a smaller budget artsy film, but with great names and great writing. And with Jodie directing, it was like, it sounded dreamy. Same time I had a dear friend of mine, a dear couple friend of mine, Bo Flynn and actress Marley Shelton. were involved in a movie called Bubble Boy, and wanted me to play a contortionist in that as well. As Bubble Boy travels the country on this little mission to find the girl of his dreams, he comes across different characters along the way, and one was a circus gang, and so I was battling like, oh my gosh, what do? You go with the art movie with the huge names, or do you go with the friends that you know and trust, and it's going to be a more of a summer like box office movie? It was a tragic decision to have to make, but thank goodness Bo and Marley, the friends of mine, understood, because she, as an actress, had also made this decision before when she, you know, and they understood that I had to go with the art for this one time, but please forgive me, and we'll keep loving each other. They were very understanding. Russell Crowe had a shoulder injury 2 weeks later, and the production was shut down and did not go forward. It was shut down indefinitely. So then coming back to Bubble Boy, hey, I'm free now, already been cast. So then after having two movies, vying for my involvement, and then neither of them now is a possibility, and I just turned 40, I was like, okay, that's the end. This will never happen again for me, blah, blah, blah. Little did I know, Mick, that my biggest years were still way ahead in my 50s. But here's what I learned about my midlife crisis. And that is, many of us have a midlife crisis when we realize that our expectations of our future when we are in our 20s, I'm going to have a mansion in Malibu, I'm going to have servants, I'm going to have a Rolls Royce. Those dreams and expectations, when you get to 40 and you realize you don't have them, that's when a crisis can happen, right? Hopefully the positive outcome of that crisis is, you know what? I don't need those things. I have all of
them.
And now I don't even want them, because that's, think of the upkeep and maintenance, right. But you realize what you do have. I have, a fantastic family. I've got, I've got the best friends. I've got, my faith in God. I mean, all the things that matter to me, I have. So then I could go on with the rest of my life being very satisfied. So midlife crises are, I think, a necessary, coming of middle age. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're going to continue to evolve throughout your life, you need to confront the negative as well as the positive. It's going to happen. Right. You're going to deal with it, and you make a choice whether you're going to be happy and fulfilled or not. And so let's talk about a couple more of the makeup-free best Doug Jones things before we wrap it up. And then I want to talk about things that might be coming up for you.
Yeah. My sitcom dreams came true. I've guest starred on a few sitcoms over the years, but I think my favorite I ever did was a Dan Fogelman production called The Neighbors on ABC. The show ran for two seasons, and I was cast as one of the goofy neighbors. We were a bunch of aliens who had taken on human form, and a human family moves into our subdivision, not knowing that all of their neighbors were these aliens who had taken over the neighborhood beforehand. So it was just a culture clash, just utter hysteria. And I did six episodes of season one of that show, and laughed every day. I looked forward to going to work. It was so great. And I couldn't do season two because I had accepted a series regular role on Falling Skies at the time. So that's the only reason I couldn't return. And then I just also, I'm a big Hallmark junkie. I know this is, your audience is not going to understand this at all, but. But I love the Hallmark Channel. I love feel good, happy. Back to my childhood. I love feel good, happy endings, low stakes. I love all of it. So I got to do a movie for their another channel of theirs, Hallmark Movies and Mysteries, where it was called The Ultimate Legacy. It was part three of a trilogy. There was The Ultimate Gift, The Ultimate Life, and The Ultimate Legacy. And I was in part three as a butler to my boss lady, played by Raquel Welch.
Oh my God.
I got to wear a bow tie and a three-piece suit and a watch chain, and I was in and out of hair and makeup in 15 minutes. It was dreamy, Nick.
That's great. Well, one of my favorite things you've done is What We Do in the Shadows. That series is so great.
Thank you.
You did like half a dozen episodes in the first season. Are you in season two, which as we're recording this, I think it premiered last night.
It did premiere last night. And I, I just had, I had so much fun on that. I was never supposed to make it past the pilot. I did the pilot episode as the Baron Afanas. And then we had so much fun. I was a one-day shoot for me because I was in just this one notable scene. Well, show creator
was Jermaine or
Jermaine Clement. He and well, Taika was our director as well for the pilot. Right. So I got to meet and work with both of them. But then, what a dream team they are! My gosh. But Jermaine said, you know, this has been such a fun time having you here. I want to bring you back later in the season if this show gets picked up. Well, it did, and he did. So I was in episode six, which was the Baron's Night Out.
Right.
Oh my gosh. Again, look forward to going to work. Again, a prosthetic makeup job that I couldn't have loved more. We laughed a lot. A lot of they wanted you to improv and go off script anytime you wanted to, and Jermaine loved everything I did, and so it was just a very quite dreamy. Yes.
And are you in season two?
No, that was the question. Right at the end when they. For spoiler alert, for those who haven't seen the show, season one yet, after my Baron's Night Out, after my big night out on the town, the sun comes up and I fry. So, accident. Then when they're putting my carcass away in a later episode, my charred carcass, right before the coffin closes after their ceremonial goodbye to me, my eyes start glowing red and then you see it just for a split second. So Jermaine told me he did that on purpose as well, because the Baron was a bit of a hit and they just wanted to leave the window open. Could they bring me back one day? Let's just leave the possibility there. So,
So
season two, I don't believe we're able to pull it off. Partly because I was in production with Star Trek Discovery season three at the same time. Yay. So,
well, you are everywhere, and is there something we should be looking forward to that we may not have heard about yet?
Right. Well, again, season three of Star Trek Discovery is now finished and in the can. We got that done just before this quarantine started, so thank heaven we got our filming done. Post production's in process, and being worked on remotely from homes as it can be. We have a lot of visual effects, musical scoring, and voice looping ADR to do. So that's where they're trying to navigate how to get that done. So that's still coming to CBS All Access sometime later this year. And also the feature film that I have finished and in the can that has not come out yet is a remake of Nosferatu.
Yes, I've been hearing about this.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. That was a dream role for me. That was my bucket list character of all the prosthetic makeups and transformations. What's the one that I hadn't done yet that I would love to do? And the answer was always Nosferatu. I wanted to play Count Orlok more than anything because he was the vampire that romanced me the most, watching him as a young person, because he was so hideous, and I felt hideous, and I understood that, but he didn't have any clue how hideous he was. He was a regal count in his day, and he has no idea he's faded into this monster of a thing. So I related to that part of him, and he just wants to survive like any monster does. We got to do that. David Lee Fisher, the director, he wrote a screenplay. So it is a talkie with sound, but filmed in the old school style of the original silent film, to the point where we were filmed in front of a green screen. There's a green screen element to every frame of this movie, of this remake. And what is green in the screen has been filled in with footage from the original film. So he created backdrops off the original movie. He did the same process in an earlier film that we did together, David Lee Fisher and I, we did The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. He did a remake of that. Wow. Also took the silent film and made it into a talkie with sound. That was done in black and white, and that is also on the YouTube in its entirety for free. If you look up Cabinet of Dr. Caligari 2005, you'll find it.
Awesome. Doug, thank you so much for joining me, and so great to catch up with you, and look forward to doing it again soon.
And me too, you. Thank you for having me so much, Mick. I have lots of you and I have another bit of history. Of course, as the creator of the Masters of Horror, when that was kind of redesigned for network television as Fear itself, I got to play in the Skin and Bones episode, which it was another human role for me that I did enjoy, but I kind of like morphed. I got monster-ish as this episode progressed. I was a Wendigo.
Yeah. Larry Fessenden.
Larry Fessenden, dear, dear director and writer friend and actor friend. And he's just, isn't he delicious? Yeah.
Wonderful guy. Well, Doug, thank you so much, and can't wait to do it again. And once all of the smoke clears, to see you in person.
Yes, it's a deal. Let's have a we'll hug it out when we can again, okay?
Great. Thanks, Doug. Take care.
Thank you, Mick.
If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you would let the world know about it by reviewing and rating it on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. If you have comments or questions for our Ask Mick Anything shows, send them to producer Joe at Joe Russo Tweets or to at Mick Garris PM on Instagram or Twitter or the Postmortem with Mick Garris Facebook page. This is a brand new address, so don't forget it. That's at Mick Garris PM on both Twitter and Instagram. And if you'd like to see my vintage and recent video interviews, making of documentaries, and audiobooks of some of my short stories, go to my website, mickgarrisinterviews.com.
Thanks for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every other Wednesday and subscribe on iTunes.